So wait a second. FDR comes into office during a Great Depression and was elected three more times. President Obama comes into office during this Great Recession, and what exactly is going on? Now, I know what you might be thinking. Stop that kind of talk. There's so much more detail there than just that sentence. Well, yes, you're right, and that's what we're going to talk about today, detail and history. But first, here's the present. By all conventional political measures, the president is in trouble. The Gallup organization recently announced the president has been in minority approval for the last six quarters, a majority of his presidency. That means the rating of under 50% when people are asked the question they've been asking since Harry Truman. Do you approve of the job the president is doing? Under 50%. The average of 10 quarters is 46.8. The historic president, sworn in amid a national emergency, as his unpopular predecessor took the green helicopter home, above teeming crowds with iconic hope posters, scoring a 63% Gallup poll rating in his first month, passing legislation, changing policy, changing politics as we know it. All of that never quite materialized. A straight Gallup slide, 54% by the fall of 09, 49% by December, and 42% Gallup job approval rating. Oh, of course, yes, it's happened before, this third year doldrums of presidents. 1977, a new president with a 66% Gallup approval in his first month was going to change politics, throw out the corrupt ones, and never lie to us. That regular guy, Jimmy Carter, the peanut farmer, took office in America as we were discoing and watching Star Wars in galaxies far, far away. He met some roadblocks, met a few snafus, and dropped to 57% his first year. By 1979, his third, Americans were burning disco records, waiting in gas lines, and he was earning a 29% job approval Gallup. Carter's fall has got to worry the current White House advisors. And yet there's another example. While millions of Americans were moonwalking to Michael Jackson's Billie Jean with shiny singular gloves and watching Elliot and his bicyclist buddies bring that little extraterrestrial up into the sky, an incumbent president was having a little trouble phoning home to the voters. President Reagan's Gallup approval was 37% in January 1983. By May, it was up a tick, 45%, but the same in October. No improvement, a poor economy, a rebuilding opposition, a ridiculed Star Wars plan that scared some voters, deficit concerns, Lebanon. In May of 1983, a poll said that Carter's vice president, Walter Mondale, would be the next president if the election were held that day. Well, as is always the case in those polls, the election wasn't held that day. And by the time the election was held, the economy improved, troops were out of Lebanon, and Rawhide was up to 50% in Gallup polls, and he won 49 states. I can only imagine that in Renegade's White House, that example is what they are thinking of, praying for, hoping for. After all, it's not like a high Gallup rating in your third year would shale the president. Everyone is subject to that decision made in the tiny little hot room in Philly in 1787. There shall be a contest every 4 years, war, panic, strike, depression aside. George H.W. Bush won easily, beating his unnamed Democratic challenger in the generic polls of 1991. But then he dropped suddenly in his fourth year. Under 50%, for the first time in his presidency where he had averaged in the 70s. And he kept dropping in 1992 and was beaten. Right now, and for most of this year, President Obama loses these type of generic polls, the generic Republican opponent polls, and he's done one thing. He's attracted a large field to run against him. Now, they're not all necessarily heavyweights. A lot of them are formers. We're about to see the first sitting governor enter into the race, Rick Perry of Texas. Not only that, while Gallup still records high support, 72% among the president's liberal base, the establishment liberals aren't as supported. Listen to this. Like most Americans, I have no idea what the president believes on any issue, Perhaps those of us who were so enthralled with the magnificent story he told in Dreams of My Father appended a chapter that wasn't there, one where he resolves his identity and comes to know who he is and what he believes in. Ouch! That's from that right-wing paper, The New York Times, an editorial by Drew Weston. It's not only the gray lady. Scan the liberal blogs and you'll find defenders of the president, but more than a few negative comments and requests for Bernie Sanders to throw his hat in. What happened? Two-word answer is the economy. But I think there's more. And I don't want to pile on the president, but I will a little bit. First of all, expectations were huge. In 2009, I, as examiner of history, couldn't believe the things that American thought that the executive branch could actually get done. Then there was spent political capital. The stimulus bill, but more so, the healthcare reform represented a rallying point for opponents. The benefits of these programs, such as they'll come to be, were all scheduled to roll out over time, right? So the stimulus program had injections of money each year. Not all the money's been spent even now. And the healthcare bill, the subsidies, which one could say is the main benefit of the program, takes effect in 2014. Yet, as there's some bad sides to any program, those bad sides are visible now, most notably the contribution to the deficit. That's visible now, and the benefits perhaps will come later. It's like, take this pill, it'll make you sick, and your skin will turn green, but, you know, eventually we think you might have a 50% chance of getting better. The next point is subjective, I know. But I don't think the President Obama has matched the candidate Obama in his speaking style. His speeches to the nation have been calm, serious. Perhaps that was good for the calamity that we faced in 08, but not great communicator stuff. There's no hero, no villain, often no plot in his speeches. Oh, and then there was that oil spill. Remember that? Little momentum killer. And again, the economy. But all of this could be put aside for a moment, I think. The other issue that this president has is his Whiggish approach to the office. Whigs like Clay, Taylor, Webster opposed the strong presidency. Of course, Clay never got his little hands on the throne, and Lord knows what would have happened if he did. But in his rhetoric, not being president, he was against the kind of early imperial presidency that Jackson was creating. One day, I'll read to you Webster's attack on the presidential mandate, a concept we take for granted now that he really ate into. We don't have that kind of time. His approach, the president's Whiggish approach, as demonstrated on the healthcare debate and this recent debt ceiling debate, has been to essentially let Congress do it. This may be some of fighting the last war. It may be because President Clinton got killed, absolutely killed, when the Clinton healthcare plan was attached to him, had his name on it, and then the plan died. Or it just could be his personality. Now that we're have some visibility on it 3 years into the office. At least from what has happened in the first term, it's the most Whiggish approach since Coolidge or William Howard Taft, in my view. Around the time of the healthcare debate, I talked about Taft's tariff reform, which he proposed the reform just as Obama proposed and continued to push for healthcare reform, and certainly his persistence was part of what made it happen. But in terms of the content of the plan, that is, it's ridiculed by as Obamacare by opponents. That is really blue dog Democratic care. That bill is essentially a compromise out of moderate Democrats trying to earn the support of Republicans, not succeeding. Because of his approach to kind of distance himself from legislation and action, Obama gets all the blame and no credit. Now, if what I'm saying is correct, if President Obama campaigned in sweet poetry and he governs in dense verse, listen to what this newspaper writer in the Literary Digest said about FDR in the 30s. It was quite the reverse. Roosevelt the candidate and Roosevelt the president are two different men. In the first role, he was famous for his beguiling smile, soft words, punchless speeches. The oath of office has transfigured him into a dynamic aggressiveness. William Allen White, big progressive writer, said, "Well, was I just fooled in him before the election? Or has he developed? He's got poise, magnitude, and more than all, power." These men and many others made these kind of remarks as he began his presidency because they saw action action coming from the White House with the president's voice and signature. In 100 days, you saw the most energetic legislative period in the nation's history. After a sheepish 1932 campaign in which he talked about the economy, an economy in government, balanced budgets, and yes, made passing references to government spending mostly to feed starving people, didn't talk about deficit spending, and used the vague term New Deal. After that campaign, when he took the office, Franklin was unleashed. Herein lies a big difference between Franklin Roosevelt and President Obama, an obvious matter of time missed by most observers. March 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt took office, was over 3 years from the stock market crash. So you had 1930, 1931, 1932, three terrible years. Mind-numbing unemployment, starvation, all spent with the country run by Herbert Hoover. Not Franklin. Yes, in a sense, FDR cleaned up. For the equivalent, let's take the 2008 market crash and say Bush was in office in 2009, 2010, and 2011. And then in March of 2012, Obama could come in and say, okay, let's get to work, with the same majorities that he had in 2009. See, history's helpful when you apply it right. That's the way you'd have to see it to make the exact comparison. But not only that, Bush turned out to be no Herbert Hoover. He gave his Treasury Secretary authority to work out a plan. In his recent memoir, still, he expressed outrage that his own party wouldn't support the TARP program. And he had to convince them, he had to turn them around and get the support of Democrats to pass it. Eventually they did. $700 billion was spent, an unbelievable sum of money. This combined with the AIG takeover, this combined with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac takeover. Now it's true. Herbert Hoover, we know, was misrepresented as an arch conservative. He wasn't. He was a person who personally had helped to feed people. He had helped at disaster sites. He wasn't anti-government. And in fact, he did extend the federal government's reach. And nothing that had any kind of impact compared to the economic calamity that was going on. People going to their banks and finding the doors shut. No, President Obama didn't get lucky. And he didn't get the keys after the previous incumbent was seen to have sat on his hands in an emergency. It's likely that some of these steps avoided the counterfactual that I think was out there that you can't see. Possible death of commercial paper, which pays most of our salaries if we work for corporations. Run on banks, overwhelming the FDIC, and just simply a deeper in recession, and hard as it is to believe, more unemployment than what we had. Hard to argue a counterfactual, so we can't do it for long. President Obama had a role as president-elect in pushing the TARP program, but didn't get credit for a lot because he wasn't in office. And a counterfactual was a hard place to run for re-election on. Indeed, when Franklin Roosevelt got into office, he engaged in not one consistent policy direction, but lots of them. He accepted a banking bill that was written by Hoover's Treasury Secretary. Hoover's Undersecretary of the Treasury was still working for FDR. This while he made a speech about the money changers and kicking them out of Washington. He slashed veterans' pensions and benefits to save money to the tune of $400 million in an austerity program that shocked the Democratic Party in Congress. He created an NRA organization to facilitate, essentially, government-legalized collusion between companies in order to keep prices up. It's among other things that the NRA did, and it was ruled eventually unconstitutional. He paid farmer subsidies to get farm prices up so that they would not grow an excessive amount of crops. He took us off the gold standard and then started hoarding gold in order to make gold less of a resource to go to. That seems like such a crazy idea now with gold for $1,700 an ounce, right? Well, then yes, he began the things he's often known for, spending on a civilian conservation corps, the summer camps, federal relief aid, and the very limited CWA, which employed adults in various simple tasks. FDR used a kind of nutty patchwork of plans and then took credit for the general performance of the economy. There's no doubt in my mind he benefited hugely not only from his own political talents, but also from timing. President Obama doesn't have that timing, and it appears he has chosen not to pursue the strong executive approach. Now, What does it all mean for the president? Things are bad, but no one in Ames should be hoping for the straw too much. The history of re-elections is this. Only 10 men have snatched the presidency from an incumbent in the Republic's entire history. Jefferson, Jackson, Harrison I, Harrison II, Cleveland, Wilson, FDR, Carter, Reagan, Clinton. That's it, 10 men. Also, we've had three elections now, 1916, 1948, 2004, where president of mild popularity and a spirited, reinvigorated opposition still eked out a re-election victory. A third piece of candy for the current president is the state Gallups are a little better in some places. Florida, 47, above his disapproval. Wisconsin, 50%, well above his disapproval. Iowa, same thing, 49. Though Virginia and North Carolina are a little muddy, and Indiana doesn't even appear to be on the table anymore. Still, the state Gallups provide some good news. And where it's measured, President Obama's personal approval has always been a little higher than his job approval. But this is one of those things where we'll continue to watch as developments happen. I want to thank you for listening. The website is myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. There's a Facebook site where you can go on and discuss, hopefully politely, politics and history. And if you like the program, please tell somebody about it. iTunes is a good place, for instance. Thanks for listening.